Welcome to the Building Science Podcast.
Bringing the human factor to architecture and design.
Brought to you by Positive Energy in Austin, Texas.
Okay, hello and welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the Building Science Podcast. I'm Christoph Irwin, here today with Tessa Bradley and Graham Irwin, my bog brother from previous podcasts. Well, today we're going to be talking about passive house as an architectural style. So it's going to be a lively discussion, I have no doubt. We're going to start by having a little fun and letting them introduce each other. Tessa, would you please introduce Graham Irwin?
I would love to introduce Graham Irwin. Graham has been a dear friend of mine in the passive house community for, gosh, I think it's been over a decade now. And I met Graham because he was helping teach the passive house training that I took in Seattle, which I think was maybe the second training they'd ever done in the United States. And Graham had attended the first and got his CPHC. And we bonded through trauma, I think, trying to do this without a manual. And it, you know, like our test was poorly put into English from its original German form. And Graham has gone on to do amazing things in the passive house community. And I just greatly admire the way he thinks about things and the way that he can communicate to others how he thinks about passive house. And it's always my pleasure to just get to be in his sphere. So I would say that's my introduction for Graham.
Love it. All right, Graham, your turn. Please introduce Tessa.
Tessa Bradley is a principal of Artisans Group in Olympia, Washington. And yes, we became acquainted, I believe it was 2010. Isn't that right?
I think so.
And Tessa was by far the youngest attendee of a passive house training that I was helping deliver. So she was early on in North America getting trained in passive house, and early on in her life being trained in passive house. And she was working for a design build firm, as I understand, and went back to the design build firm and said, I'm going to quit and go do passive house. And then the principal of the design build firm said, nope, we're going to switch and pivot to do passive house. And they did design build for a long time. And then she has since transitioned to being one of the principals in a women owned firm. So not only is she doing amazing things in terms of architecture and environment, but like socially and for equity and all of that stuff. So she's walking the walk and talking the talk and designing amazing stuff. I could go on, but is that enough?
That's more than plenty. Thank you. That was great, Graham. And I chuckled at the beginning because you said Tessa Bradley is a principal at Art. I thought you were just pulled up her LinkedIn bio and you were just going to like deadpan hers.
Read it. That would have been funny. I should have said that Graham is a principal of Essential Habitat too, which is his firm.
Yes. Yes. And that they'll both show up on the show notes. So let's dive in. So today we're going to be talking about the power of architecture in society from the specific angle of the power of passive house architecture in society. And I think the three of us recognize that we're really onto something big here. Like, this is huge, right? The power of the enclosure to do the heavy lifting to help with the whole energy transition is lurking here. And yet I think that actually, I don't remember which one of you birthed this idea, but the idea is, does passive house qualify as an architectural style or not? And you know, just as if, you know, I consulted the ChatGPT gods, and here's some of the things that qualify as architectural styles: the relationship between form and function, the relationship to nature and the geobiosphere, both promoting and responding to evolving cultural paradigms. And don't worry, you don't have to write these down. I'm going to bring these up. So just to do that, say that again, both promoting and responding to evolving cultural paradigms. The owner-occupant experience, the design process intent and the design process outcomes, material palettes, and visual spatial elements. So those are sort of some of the like building blocks that could be put in to create an architectural style. Maybe we'll have time here to get through all of them. Let's see. So you guys, it's going to be a bit of a melee here. So I'm just going to throw this one out. Let's start with relationships between form and function. Does Passive House have its own style in that regard?
Well, I think it started sort of rough in that realm, right? Because like, I think like to be attracted to Passive House, maybe you're a very nerdy kind of architect. And I feel like it kind of, in the early stages, please don't hate me if you were one of the early stages, but I think in many cases, my own work as well, my first Passive House, you know, I like, but is definitely very pragmatic. But I think many people abandoned art in favor of function early on. And I think that you have to hold both with equal power to do anything meaningful. So I think we actually started an uphill battle as architects, because like a lot of the early Passive House work was really ugly. And that wasn't good for it.
I guess I'll preface this by saying that all architectural styles are recognized in retrospect, right? So we, and this is something I've been kind of going on for a while, like what architectural style arises from Passive House? We won't know that, you know, until we're in history books or aren't or whatever, or someone else is, I think. Mm-hmm. But I totally agree with Tessa. I think I've been thinking a lot about marketing with Passive House, and I think one of the challenges we've had is that we've all drunk the Kool-Aid and we all think it's great, like you're sort of saying, this nerdiness, right? We're so enamored with the technical aspects of it. And for that matter, the design, the power that it gives the designer, you know, about being able to optimize your building. Because to me, like, there is no separation between the performance of the building and the design of the building. To me, both of those things are designed together. And it's why I think it's pretty common for a lot of people once they start designing Passive House and or building Passive House, for many people it's very hard to go back to not doing that, because it feels like I'm just doing what I can do and know how to do, missing a bunch of stuff, not different, like just insufficient or incomplete. So, you know, as designers, we got enamored by all this technical and all this possibility, but it's kind of like with I use the EV analogy, electric vehicle, right? I fully believe that Passive House is essentially, or passive building, whatever you want to call it, the EV of architecture. Mm-hmm. But for so long, we were so focused on, oh yeah, it's an EV. It's got batteries and an electric motor or two and like wheels, and somehow they're electrically coupled. And then there's a charging thing and this and that. It's like, okay, what does the vehicle look like? What does it feel like? What are the people that get in it? How does it make them feel about the experience? What does it communicate about the people who choose, you know, who want this? What does it say about them? And that's really where the architecture part of it is, and what was missing, you know, it was like, the EV isn't just, yeah, of course the battery and the motor and the wheels are important. That's what makes it what it is, but that's not enough, right?
You know what I'm struck by, Graham? Like, as you're sitting here talking about it, I just pictured like one of those iconic mid-century modern photographs by like Julius Shulman, where it's like a steel structure, you know, hovering out off a cliff.
Yep.
You know, with an elegant woman seated in the
dark and white house.
You know,
the small house,
like, and I feel like when you were talking about Passive House as a movement, you could have just as easily been talking about steel, right? Like, you know, the marriage of the performance and like how it gives you so much power as an architect. And like, I was just struck by that. I've never thought about it quite that way, but, as you, it, it was remarkable as you said what you said.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight, and I totally get it. And I do think, and you, of course, Tess, I have no doubt you will let me know if you disagree, but there's a tendency, I think, among a lot of passive design architects to lean toward a modernism, an updated modernism, but that sort of mindset kind of care of technological perfection, right? And disruption or innovation, to me feels consistent, right? And again, we're not building glass and steel boxes because we know what those problems are, but it tends toward, I think people that are involved in this tend toward wanting to innovate and improve and come up with something new. And I think the expression, right, the expression of that in the building is the art. And that's probably the lifelong challenge too, right?
Right. And oftentimes, like, the expression of the performance is where the art ends, which is perhaps my beef with being a part of this community. Because for me, you know, the end user, that's not where it ends, you know.
Right.
So great, you're comfortable and you don't get headaches anymore and your energy bills don't exist and you live in this fabulous box, but it doesn't make your soul sing. So what's
totally
the point?
Totally agree.
Right.
And I've talked a bit about this idea of a more expansive view of home performance.
Yeah.
Right. Because if we talk about building performance or home performance, like in the strict classical method, you know, you can do like this thought experiment and say, well, okay, can I meet all those things and have a really miserable, uninspiring building? And the answer is yes.
Right. Yeah. Right. For sure.
If it's just, but if one talks about a performance and one thinks about what does the word performance mean? Maybe there's more to it. I mean, technically a performance has an emotional aspect, right? And or even more in a less ethereal way, right? We think about often home performance is thought of just in the context of like separating the people from the outdoors, right? And that's important sometimes. Of course unless you're going to live outside, you want a building that's capable of providing you shelter. But if we only focus on the separation from indoors to outdoors, then people are right to be like, that just doesn't sound good to me. Right. I like indoor-outdoor connection. So, again, in this, in terms of the performance, it's a bit bigger than that to me. It does need to provide shelter and security and separation when required, but almost as it, I won't even rank the importance. It also needs to connect you to the outside,
right?
That's part of a building's performance to me. And
valuing transcendence, right? Isn't that I use this in my life all the time and I talk about it with my husband all the time, but isn't it a Taoist principle to hold two truths? So where you can believe something is 100% true and 100% not true, and you have to learn to hold each one in each hand. For me, that's very much the challenge of passive house. The performance is everything, only in the context of a transcendent building, right? That's the only time that something lasting for 300 years matters, is if it's worthy of lasting for 300 years. And that's how I resolve some opposed ideas.
This is getting really fun.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. I actually want to interject that I'm just going to step out and let you guys continue on with the podcast. I'm kidding. This is great. But it's actually so the dimensions of performance, because, you know, I'm the nerd. I'm the functional nerd in the room, you know, which really isn't true because you guys are quite aware of building function. But, you know, we've all evolved from energy as the dominant metric and, you know, arbiter of good, bad. And health and well-being have come in, you know, in those carbon and many other, but the words well-being, I think that they get glossed over. Health and well-being. Fundamentally, that's what you point to when you say about our performance. Like, what we do together is we curate, we collect, we arrange, we select and arrange materials to create an experience for our clients, right? That's, And that experience, ultimately, that's an emotional experience. Like, we want the client to say, this is a great home. I know because I've really loved living in it, right? And so I think ultimately we go to this transcendent place very quickly when we remember the reality of what we're doing is we're working to create a positive experience for our clients. But here's pivoting it back for you guys. I'd love you to respond to this or just say that's crazy. Like, a heat dome will settle over Seattle this coming summer, and your client is living in a passive house with a resilient energy system, and they'll hear the news of the heat dome coming, and their stomach will not ratchet up in fear, right? Boom, you've improved their experience, even if the heat dome never calls for their battery backup, right? Similarly, a power outage, right? You know, in the winter or something like that. So any thoughts about that? These sort of, how these performance, like these crunchy performance, you know, like having energy, having healthy air, having clean water, actually feed the positive experience of the owner. Thoughts on that?
I just wanted to comment, like, when you were saying what you were saying, I was struck by, like, how when Graham was, you know, saying his thing earlier, and I was like, oh, it's just like steel in the 60s. I was struck that, I always think it's weird what Americans separate, right? Like, so we separate building performance from, like, building in joy, right?
Yeah.
And when you were talking, I was thinking about how we separate, like, mental health from whether a person is healthy or not, right?
Yeah.
So you were, like, saying, like, well-being. You were like, it's a healthy building. We can be like, oh, no, they're perfectly healthy. They're horribly depressed, but they're perfectly healthy. Like, that's not true, right? Because we've drawn a bizarre line in the sand and said, yeah, this is a physical thing and this is not. And, like, you know, and it's not true. So I was thinking about that with, like, as you were, the words you were using with buildings too, like, that was.
Yeah.
The other thought I had, what I was struck by in your discussion about that, or that analogy, Christoph, is it had nothing to do with what the building did or did not do. You were focused entirely on how the people who lived in that building felt about what the building could or could not do. Right. So it was entirely emotional, right?
It wasn't about resiliency. It was about fear of resiliency.
Mm-hmm. Or lack of fear, or confidence and safety, a feeling of safety, right? And of course that could be delusional. Like, you could be living in a really bad house and think, oh, it's no problem. If there's a heat dome, I'll be fine. And then find out you're not. But so presumably these emotions from these people are backed up by the design and past experience and all the rest of it. But you were, I mean, what was interesting to me about that, you were speaking of people's emotions around that.
Yeah.
Not, so again, sort of a bigger view of building performance, right? You're talking about, oh, this building has resiliency. Okay, sure it does. And technically it does for this, that, and the other. But what you were really speaking of is the emotion that generates from its performance.
Yeah.
Right? Again, back to flogging my analogy.
Yeah. And I'd like to interject here, and I'm getting us on to the second point. So the relationship between form and function, I think you guys have untangled it as, it needs to be a both and. It needs to be beautiful, you know, make your soul sing, and it needs to function very well. I want to be clear that the point of the building, so the next step in, you know, what makes an architectural style is responding to the cultural norms around the relationship between humanity and nature, humanity and the environment. And I want to be clear that, like, the goal of us as professionals and you all listening almost certainly is not just to make the client have well-being at the expense of, you know, nature. So what about this? Do you think that passive house is, I feel like it's obviously yes. Is it responding to the needs of nature, right? The needs of the environment,
well,
the outdoor.
I mean, you know, Graham can basically live outdoors and not die where he lives. So that might be nice.
Bay Area, but, by the way.
But I live in the Pacific Northwest, and if you don't die of exposure, you'll certainly get eaten by a bear. So I think that, you know, the anecdotal things I hear about Passive House really interest me from my clients, because I feel like everyone asks the very bizarre question, but like you get why they ask it in the beginning, and they're like, well, can I open the windows? And you're like, yes, it's not a NASA sealed box. It can be a NASA sealed box, but it doesn't have to be. But I've found that my clients can enjoy the swing months more here. You know, like I live in an old, leaky, mid-century modern house, and it's very hard to keep warm. And I have, you know, efficient systems in an attempt to do that, but it's difficult. And when we get a cold snap, or if I leave a sliding glass door open, you know, the whole building will cool down and it will take, you know, hours to warm it back up. You know, my Passive House clients, they get a really beautiful rainy day and they'll throw open one of their huge sliding glass doors and just enjoy it, because the minute they close that door, the building is, you know, back up to temperature. They didn't waste much energy doing it. You know, I hear that the swing months, they open their windows a lot more than they used to, because, you know, you're not living with the fear of not being able to warm your house back up efficiently. And then the flip side of that is we're getting those heat domes, right, Christoph? And we're getting the effects of climate change. So it's getting hotter here, and most of our buildings don't have air conditioning. And so the ability of a Passive House to stay cool is allowing people to enjoy the outdoors more as well. Almost, because you could go outdoors when it's 100 degrees out, enjoy it, and then go back to your refuge, right? So all of it, I feel like, is leading to a greater connection to the outdoors in kind of a roundabout way.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Tessa, what you spoke to there about people saying, well, can I open my windows, again speaks to this initial very narrow, you know, very narrow, well, it wasn't a narrow focus necessarily, but a narrow set of assumptions around building performance. You know, you say airtight, an airtight home. Well, what does that mean to someone that just hears that? Well, it sounds like a hermetically sealed environment. So it's not really about that. It's about getting a draft-free home, right? I mean, it's about having control over whether air is leaking through or not. And that's a very different, you may be talking about the same thing, but it's talking about it in a very different way. And
yeah.
Another thing that occurred to me, so some of the stuff, I've been trying to do a lot of marketing, because like you said, you know, if your survival doesn't depend on building performance, how does one get people to be motivated to do this in milder climates? And you know, I was doing some writing, updating the website, and you know, I started out and I was writing what I always kind of, you know, I'd written. I was started in Passive House in the U.S. early on, and there was, you know, a lot of it was like parroting stuff that was already out there, or like explaining what Passive House was, which was just kind of redundant. You know, I'm glad I don't feel the need to, you know. Fias and PHI and all those people like can give you the details. I don't need to speak about that anymore. But anyway, I was, you know, diving in once again on the website, about to describe this thing about passive buildings, and I started to say, you know, the temperature is perfectly controlled. And then it struck me, like, this is America. Like, no one wants to be perfectly controlled.
Yeah, or saying airtight, an airtight structure.
Right. And perfectly controlled. That doesn't sound compelling. And then I remembered Lisa Heshong had a book. It was actually her master's, her PhD, Thermal Delight. And then I was like, that is what I want to talk about. And Visual Delight as well as a follow-up to wonderful books. But
I think that's why the anecdotes are so much more interesting, right? Like, we talk about Passive House a certain way, and then the people that live in these homes talk about it a very different way. You know, they're
And to me, it's not about perfectly controlled. It's about thermal delight. And that's sort of what you're saying too, Tessa. You might, you know, cold, rainy day, you might open the door. You might walk outside, get hit by a little rain maybe, or like stay out there long enough and you're like, wow, it was really fun being out here, but I'm starting to feel cold again. And then you go back in. And so it's more than just an equation, right? It's
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And that, and I do think that that kind of emotive thing connects and goes all the way through this. And as architects, that's really our task, is to take all of these technical details and combine them into something that's emotive and inspiring. And I'll take a little exception with what you said earlier, Tessa, saying, oh, the earlier passive houses were ugly. I don't even mind ugly. I'll take ugly as long as it's inspired ugly, right? I just don't want uninspired, like banal. So
I'm like more outcome. Like if it's ugly, I don't like it. Like I don't care if you were doing a good thing, like, and you made something that lasts 300 years. Stuff that's better gets taken care of better. Like for me,
I totally get you, but I'll take something that's provocative, right? And someone might say, oh, that's really ugly, like a brutalist thing, or I don't know what. Like, it doesn't have to necessarily be pretty to me, but if it's uninspired,
that's
worse for me, right? And that may, and again, we're playing with words here. To me, that's ugly, right? Like, I find McMansions ugly. Agreed. Now, are they ugly? I don't know. I mean, they've got Greek columns, and I don't know what else is the soup du jour, and like a million gable ends and stuff like that, or whatever it is. Like, obviously, some people think that's really attractive, but I find it quote unquote ugly because it's just
benign.
Yes, but or worse than benign. Like, it's just ugh. Like, it, look at all that stuff that was misused and produced something that's completely uninspiring. Like, I'd rather be shocked than, it's like, you know, I'd rather be shocked out of complacency. This is just me speaking personally, than bored.
You're making me think of my first passive house that I still very much like, but the design definitely borders on brutalist. And, yeah. To the market it came into, modernism wasn't in full swing yet. You know, today's modernism. And so, you know, I would say that they underwent a shock, kind of like you're referring to.
So I'm curious, have either of you found yourself face to face with a choice between getting the building certified according to the standard, the passive house standard, either one, and the artistic expression you really wanted to create?
You know, I've had some projects, you know, where I live, some of the projects are in the woods. And when they're very, very shady, they're very, very difficult to certify. Mm. And there does become a point where I don't feel like it's a rational use of effort to make, you know, a giant snorkis that faces snout south and like, you know, snakes up through the trees and like, you know what I mean? There becomes a point where it's like, this doesn't make any sense and I'm not going to do it, you know? So did I back those buildings into some bizarre solution to try and certify them? No, I just made them as good as I could with the program I had, you know? Did I get rid of the big, beautiful glass walls into the woods? No, I did not. Because I wasn't missing passive house by 400%. I was missing it by like 20%, right? So it's still a better house than anything else for 40 miles around it, right?
Yeah.
So I have made compromises like that around certification.
Yeah.
But it's still energy modeled and it's still totally informed by all my other certified projects. You know, I learned something on every single one.
Yeah, I would say, and again, part of it's reflective of the climate that I'm in. But I am want to say that I've never really been concerned with the standard, the certification standard. I exceed it all the time.
Whoa. Fascinating.
Now it's, you know, that's a little bit of an oversimplification because in our climate, if you're doing this well, to my opinion, you have to straddle the line, very careful balance between winter and summer performance. And I actually apply stricter criteria on that than at least the classic passive house standard has, right? And I'll get geeky for a minute. You know, the classic passive house standard, there's this percentage of overheating, right? And it's the percentage of hours of the year, and I think it's 74 degrees Fahrenheit, I think, or 25 C, I don't remember. But the percentage of the hours of the year that the building, the interior of the building would be over this temperature.
I think it's over 76 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, something like, whatever. It doesn't, I don't care. Whatever it is. It's some, you know, basically, if you didn't have a mechanical cooling system, your building would exceed this temperature this many hours of the year. And so, and they say if it's over 10, and you can certify it at basically any number, but if it's over 10% of the year, which is huge, a tenth of the year, it's uncomfortable without cooling. Some climates you can't avoid it, but like, I'm like, that's no. Like Tessa, you were saying, like in coastal California, like residential, single family residential air conditioning is pretty rare. Inland it changes, but at least coastally, it's pretty rare. And passive buildings, you know, are really good at retaining heat. And it's, and if you don't do this well, you can make a building that maybe uses less energy to stay comfortable in the winter, which is something, but it will be noticeably uncomfortable in summer. And so I apply heavier criteria. Like for me, 10% is way too high on that. And it's mostly a shading issue, really, in a lot of these climates. Kind of forgot what I was, I started. But what my point was, about the compromising around the standard. So it's not, I haven't hit that. And the problem, you know, it's so sort of cooked into me that good design is high performance design that I don't view those as a dichotomy. Now, were I to hit something like that, like Tess is saying, and I've consulted on projects like in New Mexico, where if you don't have good solar gain, you're not getting anywhere close, you know, every project to me has to have a sensible narrative, right? Like to me, it's mostly about balance too. So if I'm doing a project and I'm optimizing all of the envelope aspects of it, and I realize that I've gotten to the point of diminishing returns, and to get it past that is just ridiculous, then designing that to be certifying to me is ridiculous. This is supposed to make sense.
Right?
It's supposed to make sense, and your building should be amazing. So make amazing buildings that make sense. And yeah, if it's off by a few percentage points, it makes sense to do that. Like Tessa, what you're talking about makes sense. You're in the middle of the woods, you're building a house there. It doesn't make that, again, sort of back to this idea of like the strict building performance criteria would have you do a building with no windows, maybe, right? I mean, maybe a little bit of daylighting, but maybe with LED lights, maybe you would, if you strictly were running a spreadsheet on it, maybe you'd be using less power if you built a building with no windows whatsoever and just use LEDs. That might, you know, there is a circumstance in a climate where that would be more energy efficient, right? A higher performance building.
The one I hear is like cut down the trees. And I'm like, we don't want to cut down the trees. We like the trees.
Right. Or cut down all the trees, right? Or whatever. But it's like, that doesn't make sense. It's not sensible. And this is...
I do think it's good to note too that Graham, like, I don't think you and I like have to make a lot of compromises. Like, you know, my climate still is not like the climate Jesse Thompson is working in. You know, he might tell us both to fuck off. You know, he probably would tell us both to fuck off anyway.
He has and will. He has done and will.
But, you know, I think the harsher the climate, probably the bigger ask on the compromises, right?
And you're speaking of climate. I mean, your climate is almost as close to the climate where the classic passive house in Germany developed, right?
Yeah.
Like you're almost as close as you can get in North America to that. And, you know, and it's been an argument for a long time and, you know, about, oh, this is stupid to do this in blah, blah, blah. And, you know, even before it got into North America, like Norway and Sweden, I think were like, no, this 15 kilowatt hours per square meter per year for heating doesn't make any sense in some of our situations. So, you know, if you're doing passive house and you're doing nonsensical things with it, that seems antithetical to the zeitgeist of it.
Yeah, yeah. I think I want to, I would like to pull us back toward the focal point is like, is this an architectural style that we're seeing, or is it just a standard like code? Like no one would say IECC is an architectural style. And I think that Graham pulled the rug successfully out from under us right at the beginning, which is the right answer is time will tell. And it's also true that heating and cooling buildings consumes 30% of final energy demand, right? I'm not talking primary energy. This is final energy. That is huge. And that is something that architecture has power in. And the question is whether are architects, like, are you the emerging new normal for architects in the sense that you really understand when you're making a trade-off between form and function, between the art and the craft? Yeah. That you guys are both smiling and nodding, so you get it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like you're asking the age-old question: Can architects change? Can we get out of our own way?
And yes, okay. Can
I
we?
Don't know.
Can you?
I don't know, Christoph. Can we? Can we change? Can we get out of our own way?
Well, seriously, let's dig in. What would prevent that? Like adherence to tradition, I guess. In-group loyalty, something.
The pursuance of ego versus, you know, measurably better buildings. I don't know. I mean, Architectural Digest is still full of a bunch of bullshit, right? Like it's still full of a bunch of things that have really high embodied carbon and really poor performance. And,
yeah,
you know, there's firms out there still, you know, building these iconically tectonic, you know, steel boxes that look really cool and are so, so irrational, right? And still winning architectural awards for them. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't know if that's a question that I could confidently answer. I feel like we're breaking into camps. Cause like when I go to an event with, you know, like an AIA event with architects, it's got a vibe. And then you go to like a passive house event and it's a very wildly different vibe, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I guess I feel that way, Tessa, to some degree, but I also feel like if I'm at an AIA event, I'm like in this weird, you know, it's like Freaks and Geeks, that TV show or whatever. And then when I get to the passive, you know, FIAS conference or whatever, all of a sudden I'm among my people, right?
Right.
And like, especially when it's the design-oriented people, because again, the architects at the passive conference are not the whole group. We're kind of a, you know, subset there as well, especially people that lean really heavily into design. So like, there I feel safe. I'll add that I've seen and heard a lot of resistance in sort of classical architecture communities to passive house because it's viewed as this encumbrance on design, right? Or it's not, it's like it's sort of almost too down to earth and it's interfering with the art or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Like I was on the AIA board regionally for some time and, you know, I would have these conversations like about how women could be as good of architects as men, you know? And I'd just be like, what is this, 1965? Yeah. I don't know. And I just feel like Passive House is like 40 years ahead of like the rest of the architectural community.
Yeah, I do too.
And I feel like that rift is like the same reason that our grandparents said things that made us uncomfortable. Like, how do you bridge that gap?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't know the answer, Christoph, but I definitely see the problem.
Yeah, I'm with you completely. And there's a forward principle here, meaning like we kind of have a gestalt of what forward is like. And this thing about how much energy needlessly leaks through our buildings, I don't think there's an architect alive that would say, yeah, right, needless leaking is something I want to promote. Maybe they're not clear that they're promoting it, but I love that you went to the ego because I'm reading Eyes of the Skin, Juhani Palasma. Like, I think it's my third time through. I don't know if you guys have read it. It's awesome. There's a quote here from his book, The Eyes of the Skin, Architecture and the Senses. The gradually growing hegemony of the eye seems to be parallel with the development of Western ego consciousness, and the gradually increasing separation of the self and the world. Right? And because you just said, like, can architects change? And you said, can they get out of their own way? And then you said, their ego, right? And there's really something humbling to say, well, there are other principles at work here besides just what it looks like and even what it feels like. There's other.
Well, they're monuments to self, right?
Like monuments to themselves. Is that what you just said?
Yeah. Architects are like, we create monuments to ourselves. And I guess it just depends on what you're going to gauge a monument to be valuable for, right? Like, that's really the only difference between what we're doing and what they're doing. We've just decided that our monuments have a morality.
Wow. Got my brain lit up like a pinball machine.
I think that passive building or passive house is not an architectural style. I also believe, I don't think it is. I don't think it's any different than IECC. I mean, in terms of an architecture, in terms of an aesthetic, it's not an aesthetic. But I also think that it will be, I've sort of said this for a long time. Like, I think that it won't, sometimes, you know, in California, I'm like, why did California, you know, is supposed to be this leader, right, of technology and of environmentalism? And we are way behind in terms of building performance at this point, like, ridiculously. It's true.
Behind who? You mean Europe or Scandinavia?
A lot of the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, Washington State has the most progressive energy code in the states.
Yeah, and in any case, I've been like, well, how is that going to change? And it may be, you know, I mean, we're a big ship, right? California is like the fifth largest economy in the world if it were a country or something. It may be that this will be common practice. I have no doubt that it will just be what is. And it may be that it's not fully accepted and adopted here until it becomes an idea that California thought of, decides they thought of it, right? Like, it's not this funny, weird, not like this funny German or Illinois thing. It's like, yeah, we came up with this idea that we ought to, the envelope performance is very important and necessary and la, 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 la. And so, you know, because what is there? But I'll throw a question back out and I'll turn the floor over to you in a second, Tessa. But like, what is there in this that is unique? Every bit of it is in every building, right? Every building has these principles. How, like, give me a building that does not. All buildings have some.
But this is my challenge to you, Graham, is that in one hand, it's the two truths again. In one hand, I agree that it is a tool, not a style.
Yeah.
Because, like, passive houses can look so wildly different, and we want them to, right? Because it is a tool. We want everyone to apply it to their projects in the best way possible. So that's a tool. But then you see commonalities. So
sure,
the walls are really thick. So, like, all the designs have so much more relief than, like, a developer or a builder grade anything, right? Everything suddenly just has more shadow and more drama and more rhythm and, you know, suddenly looks different and interesting because of that. So, like, that is an architectural style, at least the start of one. So I kind of see both. Yeah.
I agree with you that there are commonalities in this, and beyond that, beyond what's necessary, technically necessary, I think it's also necessary that this be expressed, right? It can't be a style if it does not express something. And so there are things brought about by technical requirements. And then, you know, and then you root around in there, and I'll add another thing that, you know, you're going to agree with, I'm sure, is that, you know, and I don't use the word simple for this. I think that has a negative connotation, but I prefer to talk about elemental building forms, right? So rather than like some thing that just has a bunch of bump outs and extra roofs and extra windows and this and that and the other, like, piled on to create some visual interest. To me, I mean, one of my favorite things in this is to come up with something elemental, but then add some, like, one dramatic
little twist, right?
Thing that's yeah. a fundamentally deep and element, I'm using elemental again, but like,
well,
fundamentally different way of looking at something.
And that's kind of like a psychology of humans, right? Because we do something and we do it repeatedly, and whether we intend to or not, we often tend to like the things that we do repeatedly, right? So like,
yeah.
I always feel more like myself when I'm wearing an enormous sweater, right? Because I've worn enormous sweaters my whole life living where I live. And so you do it enough times and now it's you, right? So we get forced into these simplified forms, and we get used to making them a statement instead of a limitation. And now we like it, you know? So I agree. That's again in the style camp, right?
Yeah, I think that's, I feel like that's part of it. And I feel like if you don't, I don't know, I remember sometime early on someone having a discussion with me, which is pertinent to this, and saying, you know, the great thing about Passive House is it doesn't have a style. You can do any kind of building and it'll look like that. I'm like, I don't know if that's that great. I mean, it is great in that it doesn't, you know, it offers designers and clients and everything flexibility, but it's not great in terms of developing an architectural expression, because by very definition, that isn't one. Right. So to me, architecture at the end of the day, I mean, the art of it is expression. It has responsibility. There's responsibility. There's moral responsibility to house people.
Is there moral responsibility?
There is, for sure. I mean, like, I don't know, like some of the classic modernist buildings made the occupants ill. Like, I think that's not good, right? And destroying our environment's not good either. We all know this. Like, nobody, there's no one in disagreement about, well, I'm probably generalizing about people, yeah. But I think there's broad agreement that those are negative things and we should do better.
Tessa, you have a comment? And then I have an interjection.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just, again, like, thinking about Passive House as an architectural style in response to what Graham was saying, that, you know, I mean, what makes something a style is, you know, consistencies, right, that establishes patterns. And then also that they come out of a movement and a time, right? So like,
yeah.
You know, manufacturing was a new thing. So Victorians started having little manufactured knickknacks all over it, right? And what's coming out of our movement is a rebellion against a lack of quality, right? Because it's very hard to build a passive house poorly and hastily. I'm sure it can be done, but I have yet to see a poorly built passive house. So I just was like thinking about what Graham was saying. Again, it's so interesting how it can be both and neither, a tool and a movement for me.
That actually is a really good segue. I mean, what I want to do is uncover this idea that does an architectural style have to be visually discernible, or could it be an underlying, you know, less visual kind of sense? Like you just said, the qualities, and, you know, we know that the acoustic quality of a passive house is tremendous. The ability to control and have good indoor air quality, the fact that our bodies, and I held back, man, I want you to know, great restraint when you were talking about thermal comfort, right? So I didn't talk about thermal anesthesia and the connection to surface temperatures, yay. But these are all getting to, like, it's almost like when you just said quality, like a rebellion against poor quality, that's where I think the style is, or the architectural expression is. This is important. It's multidimensionally important. Get it right on multiple dimensions, not just what it looks like.
Well, and I think about, like, the craftsman movement, because there's a lot of homes where I live that
yeah.
are, you know, here's Roebuck Kid Homes, and out of that craftsman movement, because, you know, we were kind of one of the last states to get colonized and developed. So I think about those houses because they vary so wildly in what they look like.
Yeah.
You know, a four square doesn't look anything like a little gabled, you know, like Japanese inspired bungalow. They look very different. What defines them is the era they came out of and the philosophies which motivated the decisions made on the design.
Right? Now you're getting there.
So I, yeah. I do think it might not be visual. I do think it might be something, an undercurrent, like you say, Christoph.
Yeah. It's just, it's focusing on the experience of living in the home. And I believe the experience of living in the home is not just emotional. It's logistical. Like, what did I not have to do? What did I not have to experience? I don't know. Graham, comments on that? Thoughts?
It pains me to feel like I'm trending toward the obvious, but I'm just pulled to say, of course it's visual. Architecture is visual.
Like, I'm not saying it's not.
It has to be. I feel like I'm being closed-minded because maybe there is some way that it's not, but it just seems so obvious that.
Well, but it isn't. It isn't. Back to the craftsman example, like, the philosophy was to get away from ornamentation, right? And go to a simple quality construction. Those are like some of the
basics. And a return to craft, and it was ultimately like a nostalgic thing. Yeah.
But how? But when you take those philosophies and actually make them into buildings, the buildings look wildly different. So it is aesthetics.
But those are usually grouped into different styles, right? And when you said you were going through this group, you were going through this list of things. You were talking about these Sears Roebuck homes or whatever, Tessa, and saying, well, one's the four square and one's a bungalow. Well, those are different architectural styles.
But they're all considered out of the same movement. They're all considered craftsmen.
Okay, right. So maybe in style it's different from movement.
Kind of. It is different. I don't know.
No, they are. Around here they are. Craftsman is like a home that looks like these myriad of looks, you know, out of a period. Those are craftsman homes around here.
But a kit home that's a Victorian's not part of that.
Yeah, but
or a,
that would be
or
a craftsman.
Modern one is not, because it doesn't look the same. There's something, some divining line visually that changes this. Maybe there's a club, you know, like, get a little bit outside, you kind of get kicked out, right?
I just think the defining principles might be the philosophies behind why you make the aesthetic decisions you make, since the decisions vary.
Well, yeah, maybe, but then I don't know. I think architectural styles, and I'm not an architectural historian, but what I've read, you know, again, and you sort of elucidated this at the beginning, quoting from ChatGPT or wherever it got its thing. I think I remember from architectural history textbooks, like, architectural movements are a response to technology and or social, you know, whatever social conditions are happening at the time.
Yeah,
I mean, it's culture and technology kind of coming together in some way, and those things are constantly changing, and that brings forth some new architectural style or movement. And again, we're not going to know about it till later, but, you know, and Tessa, I feel like there's a lot of modernism, again, an irony to be talking about something called modernism that was developed in like 1910 or whatever, right? That was when modern architecture was modern, quote unquote,
right?
Is from like the early 1900s. But I think a lot of us are like getting back into modernism, right? Like, modern, I was thinking about this the other day, like, modernism had a time, and you were also talking about the Stahlhaus, right? And like all these Usonian houses and Eichler and all these things. And it was like, it was a new thing, right? It was like, we're doing these new buildings post-war using post-war technology and all this. And it was supposed to change. Like, it failed. All of those houses were an attempt to, like, it wasn't just to do a house, it was to redefine what a house was, like the case study movement and all the rest of it. And it failed, right? I mean, architects know about it, and people who are architectural aficionados know of these things and sing their praises, but like, it didn't fundamentally change how things were built. And so, like, modernism had a moment, and then it kind of like fell into heavy disfavor, right? And then again, you saw like a renaissance of craftsmen, right? Like, I mean, like, what was before, like, if you follow trends, right? Like, modern, quote unquote, modern is very trendy right now. Isn't that true?
Yeah. I mean, you're just making me think of a conversation I had with Jesse Thompson at the last Passive House conference, He was like, school modernism, I'm into ornamentation now, you know? He was like, now I'm into ornamentation, because why not?
Yeah, that's, he just likes to argue, but sure. But it's not,
God,
I mean, but I'm just saying, like, I think that a lot of us, I think that modernism is a big sort of appeals to a lot of us,
yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, there are people who are doing, like, I guess who are doing like I did. I mean, I did a Craftsman passive house. It was an existing passive house. I mean, an existing Craftsman, and I didn't remake it into something else. Like we rehabbed it. And so that had a Craftsman style, but I don't do a lot of like designing new houses where I'm like, oh, I'm going to make a Craftsman that looks, you know, I'm going to make a passive house that looks like a Craftsman. It feels sort of, nostalgic or
I don't know. I think in response to, you know, the things you're sharing, Graham, like all I think about is, you know, there's modern efforts to do modern architecture that are awful, and there's efforts to do ones that are great. And for me, the difference is the philosophy and the understanding of what you're trying to do and how that executes the ideas. So, you know, the modernism that sucks doesn't understand where it's coming from, where it's been, what it's trying to do. And the modernism that's incredibly effective is a reflection of those deeper philosophies, which again, for me, tend to be really tied into the architectural style, right?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I mean, there's like great country songs and great bebop tunes.
Yeah.
And terrible ones.
Both great, you know, yeah.
Like great heavy metal songs and great hymns. Like, yeah, they're different, but you know, whatever, now it's then in the art of motorcycle maintenance, like what is quality or whatever, right? But like, but I do, like in terms of the movement, or if we're talking about an architectural style, I guess I feel like to some degree we're products of our era, and there is, there is an enthusiasm for modernism again, right?
Yeah.
And we're like, oh yeah, we're like, and some of that is, you know, some of it's convenient and compatible with this, because if you're doing like this, sort of very dealing with a lot of technical underpinnings, like that's kind of, you know, different than like, I don't know, doing a free form mud hut. I don't know. Like, I guess you could do that and do passive house with it, but it would feel really split brain at that point. Right. Like, I don't know.
You know, so this has been really, we're going to start to bring this toward a landing here. I've really enjoyed listening to you guys play off of each other. And I think we actually have made some progress bringing up ChatGPT again. An architectural movement refers to a collective effort or a period in which a group of architects share common ideas, principles, philosophies, and goals, right? Whereas a style, and there was a several bullet points, but the style, the first one there, refers to a set of common aesthetic, formal, and technical characteristics that define the visual appearance and design language, right? And they go on. So I believe that my initial framing question, where I was saying style, I was meaning movement. And, you know, from a thermodynamic, like, so I'm a physicist, you know, I own it. Round tires roll better than square tires. There's no way around it. You know, better thermal control layers leak less heat than air leaky control layers, right? So, and I do believe that society moving forward is going to say, this resource, even if it's from limitless renewable sources, it's still a precious energy source. Let's use it carefully. I don't think society is going to be not saying that in the future, right? And it's currently sort of still not saying that. So yeah, these don't have to be final thoughts, but movement versus style, you guys are nodding. So you think, yes, there is a movement that Passive House is associated with, not necessarily a style, because it could be bebop or hymns or reggae or jazz, right?
Yes, I would agree with that implicitly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm more interested in movement as well.
Yeah.
Style doesn't really interest me so much.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no, there is, I mean, all movements have a style develops, right, or is observed, I think, of movements, mm-hmm. right? And I think a movement that had no observable style probably couldn't be discerned, right? It'd be like, oh, here are a bunch of people that liked each other or hung out or had some common ideas, but nothing they produced is of any way. There's no way to like connect them. That's pretty hard to talk about.
I think when you take a salt box passive house designed by Jesse Thompson in Portland, Maine, and you put it next to one of my hyper modern glass boxes in the woods, I think you'd find a lot of commonalities.
That's what I'm saying. There's stylistic. Okay. There are stylistic, and you know, we can talk about where all that came and like try to dissect everyone's psychology and all the rest of it. But you know, it's all there.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
You guys are actually reminding me of a question I'd really love to ask you opportunistically, which reminds me of a Steve Martin joke. Steve Martin said, yeah, my writing style really improved in my second novel. That's when I first started to use verbs. And, you know, this idea, like Graham was saying earlier about windows, right? Like you could argue from an energy perspective, you know, the perfect home has no windows. Well, of course, passive houses have windows. And I'd really like to ask you kind of specifically, like you just mentioned, you know, modernistic with big expanses of glass in a passive house. Yes or no? Passive houses can have windows and even big windows. Is that a yes or a no?
I mean, look at our portfolio for 2 seconds and you'll see lots of passive houses with lots of windows, lots of glass all day.
And yet people don't relate to it that way. I mean, clients and many, many architects think, well, and this gets into the whole relationship between architectural, style or movement and glazing as it currently stands. But many architects say, I would love to design passive house. It fits my ethos, but my design style is with a lot of glass and therefore I can't.
But it, you know, and when you say a lot of glass, to get technical about it, right? I mean, what is the plural of impetus? Impeti? I don't know. Impetuses? We know that passive windows have really high performing glass, and the glass is actually better than the frame. And so it behooves one to use fewer larger units than numerous smaller units, right? And so that tends to be a thing, right? Like that's a trick you learn early on, like, oh, your building doesn't look that interesting, just sprinkle windows all over it and you can like make it interesting. I find it's like getting into deep waters, like how few, and again, not small, like I like big, I want the drama of that. And it's like, and you know, and also these windows are carrying heavy glass generally, and the frames are much more robust than typical flimsy windows, right? So why do I do it? Because I can. I can have these gigantic operable panes that glide, you know, it's like magic to me. It's poetry to see how these things slide back and forth, right? And it's like the just appreciating the engineering and the art of that. But those are things that you're going to get, you know, like it's a Psy install. You want to get into it, right? Like minimize your Psy install, have bigger. But I again, to Tessa's, what Tessa's saying is, yeah, I'm all about really dramatic panes of glass. Why? Because I've got really good windows and doors that can do that. And it's better than having a bunch of little ones. And it's more interesting, more inspiring.
As architects, Christoph, I would argue that, you know, they are more limited by the technology they're using than I am by the technology I'm using.
Ooh. Okay, listeners, so big news. Tessa had to go. So it's just Graham and I from this point forward. And as you've heard, we're almost at the end here.
We were talking about this thing about why aren't all architects doing this, or can they change? And I was reminded of this joke. I don't know where I heard it, but like, what's worse, apathy or ignorance?
Mm.
I don't know and I don't care.
And it hurt too when you said it. Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
So, I mean, some of it's, you know, some people need to retire. We all do, I guess, but mm-hmm. that's some of it. Right? Some of it you do. Will there be something to supplant this? Sure.
Yeah.
So it has to. I mean, we know that, right? We know that what we're doing now will be supplanted by something. And will we, after putting all this time and effort thinking about this and studying it and doing it and perfecting our own approach and developing our clientele and establishing our success, are we going to be willing to throw all that out to just take what the next thing is that supplants it? Or will we be the dinosaurs?
Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent mic drop kind of moment. An excellent place to end it. Thank you, Graham.
It was fun.
Yeah. And then, so thank you, Graham. Thank you, Tessa, even though you had to leave slightly early. And thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you next time.